Welcome to Thought Fuel.
Hello, and thank you for listening to episode 3 of the Thought Fuel podcast. Today's episode is going to be all about cults, so that should be a pretty interesting episode. But before we get to the main topic, let's talk about some fun facts. So today's fun facts are going to be all about space. We've got another themed fun facts section. I'm thinking that's kind of the way we're going to go in the future with our fun facts part of the show. You know, start doing themes instead of just random fun facts. Anyway, so today's section is going to be all about space. The first fun fact I've got here is that despite popular belief, the temperature of space is not absolute zero. It's actually about 2.7 Kelvin. Now that's about negative 455 degrees Fahrenheit. Absolute zero would be 0 degrees Kelvin, and that's 2.7 degrees Kelvin. Sorry, not degrees. When you're talking about Kelvin, Kelvin is the degrees part, so it's just 2.7 Kelvin. Anyway, like I said, it's about negative 455 degrees Fahrenheit, so very cold, but not quite absolute zero. Now, it's also not completely empty. We tend to think of space as being completely empty, it's a vacuum, there's nothing there. But it's not completely empty. There's a very low density of some particles. Those particles are mostly hydrogen and helium, so it's not completely empty. There's still something there, but it is still mostly vacuum. It's still a hard vacuum. Now, our next fact is kind of about the distance of the planets within our solar system. So Mercury is only about 26 million miles away from the sun, while Neptune is about 2.8 billion miles away from the sun. And that means that the furthest planet in our solar system, we're not counting Pluto here because, you know, Pluto got ditched as a planet, but that means that the furthest planet in our solar system is about 100 times further away than the closest planet. And now Earth is about 93 million miles away from the sun, if that gives you any kind of sense of scale. Probably not at these distances. But what could give you a sense of scale is our next fun fact. And that is, this is all about how long it would take you to get to the sun at speeds that are kind of easier to understand for the average person. So let's say you had a magic car that could fly, and it could fly through space. Now, if you had that magic car and it was traveling at highway speeds, so let's say 75 miles per hour, and you were to drive from the Earth to the sun without stopping, it would take you about 141 and a half years to reach the sun from Earth. And again, that's at 75 miles per hour, so that's highway speeds. 141 and a half years. And a plane, let's say you're in a plane traveling at 500 miles per hour, it would take about 21 years. So hopefully, maybe, I don't know, that might give you a little bit better sense of kind of the scale of the solar system and the distance between the Earth and the sun, and from there, the distance between Earth and Mercury and the Earth and Neptune and all of that. When you're talking about space, it's really difficult as humans for us to comprehend something that big and that vast. We've evolved to think of space on human terms. You know, that's both size, distance, all of that is really meant to be, or we're good at thinking of it from a perspective that suits our scale. When you're talking about huge scales like that, astronomical scales, it's a lot more difficult. So maybe putting it into human terms might help you understand it a little better. Who knows? Anyway, let's go ahead and move on to our main topic for this show, which again, we're talking about cults this episode. So before we actually start talking about some of the stories, let's first kind of go over what a cult is. Now, this is the Wikipedia definition of a cult. In the sociological classifications of religious movements, a cult is a religious or social group with socially deviant or novel behaviors and practices. The novel part, and that's the socially deviant part, was the original intent of the word. It's used to describe new religious movements. The term cult was first used in that context, at least in 1932. by the 30s, it carried a negative connotation. It was basically meant to kind of replace what had previously been called heretics or Satanists. So, at that point, it's a very negative context, connotation. So, when we're talking about cults in this episode, is it a bad word? Are we using cult like an insult almost? Maybe, maybe not. You know, I like to be as accurate as possible on this show, but that's kind of the way cults are, or the term cult is used in our everyday language, and that's probably the best way to use it here, just because it's as clear as any other word. But I don't want to offend anybody. If you happen to be a member of one of these groups that I'm talking about, please don't get offended, and please don't sacrifice me to whatever god it is you worship. So that's my little disclaimer. Get that out of the way. Don't kill me. Now, there's a lot of different stories of cults. You know, there's a lot of famous stories about cults in our popular culture that we could talk about. You know, everybody knows about the Manson family. Everybody knows about the People's Temple. Those are that's the group that committed mass suicide with the poisoned Kool-Aid at Jonestown. Although it wasn't actually Kool-Aid. That's another fun little fact for you. It was a different drink, which honestly I can't remember the name of right now, but it was not Kool-Aid, which everybody remembers it as Kool-Aid for some reason. It was some other kind of similar drink. Anyway, everybody remembers them. Everybody remembers the siege at Waco. So I kind of want to talk about some other cults that maybe not everybody knows about. These are still pretty famous cases, but not quite as famous as the others. These aren't really household names. Hopefully something a little bit more interesting, a little bit more unknown, or at least something that'll be new to you. So the first cult I want to talk about is Rajneesh Param. Now, this was more of a community, almost like a very large commune in Oregon in the 80s. And it was populated almost exclusively with followers of Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. And they basically all moved to Oregon, to this community, it was basically a small city, and that was Rajneesh Param, to follow him and to worship him. Now, this was a 64,000 acre property. It was purchased for $5.75 million, and that was in 80s money. In 2011 dollars, that would have been $14.1 million. So there's a lot of money they spent on this property. Rajneesh Param had a population of about 7,000 people. They did have real infrastructure. It wasn't just, a big field full of tents or something. They did have real infrastructure. They had a fire department, police department, bus system, all of that. They even had their own zip code, a zip code that was recognized by the U.S. government. You could get letters sent there. But despite all that, land issues still started coming up. They ended up getting into a lot of disputes with their neighbors over how the land was being used. And that's because when they originally bought the property, and what the property was sold for was for agricultural use. So this is rural Oregon, a lot of farming going on. And that was kind of what the land was supposed to be used for, was for agricultural uses. And that's not what they're using it for, obviously. They were using it for religious reasons, and the neighbors around them, other people kind of living in the countryside around them, started having a problem with what they're using the land for. So they started filing complaints. They took it up with the government in Oregon, and that really just started leading to tension between the residents of Rajneesh Param and the other residents of Oregon, and it started becoming a problem. And in 1983, a hotel that was owned by the same group, this was a hotel in Portland, was bombed by a militant Islamic group. And so that kind of pushed them even further. That pushed the residents of Rajneesh Param, who are their followers of Rajneesh, and they're referred to as Rajneeshis. So the Rajneeshis were becoming more and more upset, more and more defensive, because on the one hand, they're being kind of attacked by the residents in the surrounding area because of what they're using the land for. And on the other hand, they're being literally attacked by people like this militant Islamic group who bombed their hotel. So they're becoming a lot more defensive at this point. And in response to that, you know, those attacks, they started purchasing weapons. So they're starting to buy guns, you know, stockpile guns to defend themselves. They're seeing threats all around them, and they want to basically have a way to defend themselves. And you'll see this in a lot of other cults as well. Obviously, this was an issue with the people at Waco. That siege lasted, I think, 50-something days because they had so many weapons stockpiled. And that siege actually happened in the first place because of the weapons. It was a raid to take back the weapons because they're violating federal weapons charges or federal weapons laws. Anyway, but the Rajneeshis, they started buying up weapons, and that just kind of fueled this dispute between them and the people around them. And they had a spokesperson. The Rajneeshis had a spokesperson named Ma Anand Shili, or Sheila, and she was a spokesperson for the whole group. So basically for the whole community of Rajneesh Param. And she started, in response to all these kind of attacks at the group, she became more and more caustic. You know, she's getting more and more angry at the people around her. She's, I wouldn't say making threats of her own, but definitely getting defensive in the media and in her statements. But it wasn't long after that she and a few other people, and these were kind of high-level people in the organization, left the commune altogether. And once she left, an investigation by the government, by the U.S. government, showed that she had committed kind of a handful of crimes. One of those was the attempted murder of Rajneesh's physician, his personal physician. They had been wiretapping and bugging some of the houses in the community, including Rajneesh's. They poisoned some public officials, committed arson. So basically, she's committing a lot of crimes here. And once this was kind of close to coming up and becoming public, she fled to Germany. Once the investigation kind of showed what she was doing, she was extradited from Germany, brought back to the United States, and imprisoned. When she's imprisoned, one of the crimes that she was put in jail for was a huge poisoning, kind of poisoning event, I guess you would say. This was a series of poisonings she did at a handful of salad bars, at a handful of restaurants in Oregon, and basically she just put poison in some of the ingredients of the salad bars that ended up poisoning 750 people, hospitalized 45 of them, and that actually makes that the largest germ warfare attack in U.S. history was committed by Sheila. So obviously they kind of gave the government good reason to put her away. After that happened, Rajneesh himself left the U.S. He was having kind of legal problems of his own. He was accused of immigration violations, so he left the U.S., went back to India. After he left, the rest of his followers kind of went with him, and the community of Rajneesh Param shut down. You know, after he was gone, there was no real reason for them to stick around, so they left too. Now the property is still there. I think it's actually owned by a Christian youth group now for some sort of basically a camp for the Christian youth group to use in the summer, something like that. That was basically it for the Rajneeshis. You know, it was kind of a quick downfall there. Their whole group was only there for a few years, and it was just that kind of that series of events of Sheila leaving and being imprisoned, Rajneesh leaving, and then after that there was just no reason for them to be there, so it shut down. Now this next group is kind of a little bit more sinister, actually, in my opinion, a lot more sinister. This wasn't just one person who was kind of committing horrible acts like what Sheila did. This was a handful of people. Now this group was called the Movement for the Restoration of the Ten Commandments of God. They were formed in Uganda, again in the 80s, is when they were actually founded. And the founders of the group claimed that they could speak to the Virgin Mary, that they were basically receiving instructions from her, information from her, and they believed that the end of the world was coming. So that makes them a doomsday cult, which is pretty common now, or has been over the past few decades. You know, a lot of these, you'll see a common thread of them all thinking the end of the world is coming. This group was a little bit more serious, though, because by the late 90s, they had almost 5,000 members. So they're a very large cult, large group in Uganda, and they're spread out all around Uganda. It wasn't just one location, like with the Rajneeshis. They had kind of a presence in a lot of villages around Uganda. They told their followers that the apocalypse was going to be coming on New Year's of 2000. The problem was that New Year's of 2000 came and went, and the end of the world didn't. So when the end of the world didn't come on New Year's of 2000, obviously the members started getting a little bit upset. So some of the members just outright left, some of them started complaining, and it became obvious to the leaders that this group was going to fall apart if they didn't come up with something. So they decided that, oh, hey, and this is pretty common for groups that make predictions like this, but they said, oh, okay, so we got the date wrong. It wasn't New Year's. It's actually going to be March 17th. So they told the members of the group that the end of the world was actually coming on March 17th. And they organized a big party for this occasion. They got everybody together, got a bunch of drinks, got a bunch of food. They basically had a huge party. And this was at a village. The biggest of these parties was at a village in Kanungu. So, and this is where the leaders of the group were actually at. And most of the members were here as well. But like I said, they're spread out all around Uganda, but this was the biggest chunk of them. So they had a big party in Kanungu. Party kind of ends, and they all go to this church, a big church in town that they had to sing and pray and wait for basically the end of the world to come. But while they're all in this church, an explosion happens, and a fire breaks out at the church, and basically the church burns down. And when it burns down, it kills all 530 occupants that were inside. And when it was investigated by basically the local authorities, they heard an explosion, they saw a fire, they came and checked it out, figured out who the group was. They checked out other groups that, or other locations that the group had people at, and they found that members in the other group the other locations were killed as well. Now, at first, it was assumed that this was a mass suicide, that they had all killed themselves, but when they looked at the bodies at the other locations, it became pretty obvious that it wasn't a suicide, that they're actually murdered. And that's because they found the members in the other locations. Some of them were locked up, some of them were killed by poisoning, some of them were killed by stabbing. So it was obvious that this wasn't just them killing themselves, this was the leaders actually killing their own members. And the final death toll ended up being 778 people who are killed on this day. And it was, after it was investigated thoroughly, it was determined that the leaders of the group basically orchestrated the murder of pretty much all their members. Now, the authorities assumed that the leaders themselves had also been killed in the church fire because they were present for it. But now, more recently, it's believed that it's possible that some of the leaders may not have been killed in the fire, they might have gotten away, and that they're still alive and kind of out and about, which is pretty disturbing. You know, they kill all their members and they're not even there, which is pretty awful. It's not a 100% known sort of thing, if they lived or not. They could have died there, but apparently authorities in the area are confident enough that they got away that they're willing to publish that fact, so pretty good chance that they did, at least a couple of the leaders. There are five or six leaders of the group, and I think they're saying that only a couple of them are still alive, so not all of them, some of them. Now, this next group is interesting because it's kind of, in my opinion, it's really the epitome of a cult. This to me seems like the kind of cult you'd see in movies where they're all wearing dark robes and chanting and there's candles and all of that kind of stuff. You know, this is a really culty kind of cult. And this was the Order of the Solar Temple. Now, this group was started in France in 1984. So all of these groups were started in the 80s. I don't know if that tells you anything or not, but kind of interesting, though it's possible that this could have been kind of a resurrection of a group that has gone all the way back to 1952. But at the very least, this iteration of the group was started in 1984. Now, the Order of the Solar Temple believed that they are basically, well, their whole belief system was based on the Knights Templar. And it was kind of a weird sort of conglomeration of Christian theology, UFO religions, New Age philosophy, this Knights Templar kind of mythology. It was all just sort of wrapped together into this sort of strange religion that they had concocted. And there's a handful of cults like this, but this one became really, I guess you could say, notorious and infamous in 1994 when they ritually killed a baby named Manuel Detoy. And he was stabbed multiple times with a wooden stake by the members of the Order of the Solar Temple at one of their locations in Quebec. So, I mean, this is some really nasty stuff. You know, they didn't just kill a person. They didn't just kill one of their own members. They actually stabbed a baby to death with wooden stakes, which is just obviously awful. And the reason they did that was because they believed the baby was the Antichrist for whatever reason. Who knows why they believed that, but they did. And then soon after that, mass suicides began taking place of the members of the group. The first one took place in three different locations, two of them in Switzerland and one in Quebec. These all took place at the same time, and the total group number there was 53 members committed mass suicide at that kind of event. The next one wasn't until a little while later, in December 1995, another 16 members committed suicide in the mountains of France, and then in March 1997, another 5 members committed suicide in Quebec. Now, there was one person, not everybody killed themselves, there was one person named Michael Tabachnik, and he was a famous Swiss musician, and he was indicted for his involvement with the group, but he ended up being acquitted. He was acquitted at his first trial, and then there was an appeal made. He was acquitted at that as well. So really nobody was ever, as far as I could tell, nobody was ever put in jail for their involvement in this group. But it was just a really strange kind of set of circumstances that happened here. You know, you've got, like I said, the kind of the epitome of a cult. You've got that these people who their beliefs are kind of all built around the Knights Templar and, you know, some sort of New Age version of Christianity, and it's all kind of mixed together. You know, they literally did wear robes, chanting, and all of that. Some of the people, when they're found in the room when they had committed mass suicide, were arranged in patterns on the floor that were significant to their religion. So it's all kind of really just what you think of when you think of a cult. These guys were it. Now, obviously, what they did, you know, killing a baby is pretty, basically as awful as it gets, you know. So I think they kind of stand out for that reason, both for the imagery of it all and then what they did. So that's our last cult for our main topic, but we do have a bonus one. I think that's going to be something we're going to keep around. We're going to keep having a bonus every episode. And this bonus is about cargo cults. Now, cargo cults aren't like these other cults. That's why it's not part of the main topic. Cargo cults are quite a bit different. Now, cargo cults, in this context at least, were basically a small religion that sprung up on Pacific islands. These ones during World War II, because you basically have, you know, you've had the World War II happening, the Pacific theater on these island nations on these islands themselves, small islands that didn't even have nations. And these were primitive people that were living on the islands. And they all of a sudden see these world superpowers, Japan, the United States, coming through their ships, planes, you know, setting up supplies on the islands, all this. And to them, you know, they had never seen anything like this. These are all groups that really didn't have any contact with the outside world until this, and all of a sudden they see this huge amount of technology coming at them. And so to them, this would have seemed almost like magic. You know, it's like the Arthur C. Clarke quote, you know, any sufficiently advanced technology will be indistinguishable from magic. And that's kind of what it was to these people. And one of the biggest of these cults was the John Frum cult. And the reason it's called this, and I think this is a good one to pick, is because, well, A, it was the largest, and B, because it really epitomizes why all of these cargo cults developed, because there was a lot of them, but this was the kind of the most famous. And so these people saw all these ships coming in, these planes coming in, these GIs coming in, and the story goes of the John Frum cult, and it's not exactly sure if this is really how it originated or not, but this is the most popular theory, was that it's called the John Frum cult because the person who they're worshiping, who these native people are worshiping, was John, and he was introduced as John Frum America. So you get John Frum America. And so the reason they kind of built a religion around this was that they saw all of this technology, all these supplies, all this cargo coming in, and they thought that if they worshipped this John Frum or any of the other specific people or ideas that they worshipped, that they would basically kind of earn all this cargo as a reward, sort of in the way that most religions will have rewards for your beliefs and your worship and your service. They believe that they would earn as a reward this cargo in the form of the kind of cargo that they had seen the soldiers carrying. So everything from, you know, a Zippo lighter to planes and things like that. And so that was what they were trying to get. That was kind of even more apparent with the things they were building. So they would build things like the John Frum cult would build landing strips, big, and they're not real landing strips, but big kind of imitation landing strips that they believed that John Frum would someday fly in and land on to bring them their cargo. And this was pretty common throughout all these cults, whether it was the John Frum cult or not. And the funny thing is that even after the people that are part of these small religions kind of learned where this stuff was coming from, that this was just another country with more advanced technology, they still continued to believe it. The John Frum cult still exists today, which is pretty interesting when you consider that they're not isolated like they used to be. You know, it kind of made sense in the 40s for a group of people, a group of natives on an island, to worship this John Frum, because this is the first time they'd ever seen any kind of advanced technology, and to them it was magic. But now, you know, they can see that for themselves in a number of different ways. I mean, they could put an antenna up and get TV there. You know, there's all sorts of ways that in a modern sense or a modern version of their island that they could see where all this technology is coming from. You would think they would stop believing in it, but for whatever reason they don't. The John Frum cult still exists. It's still going on. Like I said, it's the biggest of the cargo cults, and I think it might be the only one that still exists. But in the 40s, there were a number of these cargo cults that sprung up, all basically for the same reasons and worshipping the same things. And so I've always found that pretty interesting, the idea of these cargo cults springing up just from coming into contact with kind of modern Western civilization. And so that ends our topic for this week. That was our bonus topic. If you feel like reading some more from me, you can visit my website at serialhobbyism.com. You can find me on Twitter at serialhobbyism, Facebook at serialhobbyism. I do have a Patreon account now. You can find that at patreon.com/thoughtfuel. If you don't feel like donating any money or you don't have any money to donate, you can still help us out. If you like this, rate it on iTunes. That's the best way to get the word out and get other people listening to this, is to give it a good rating and review on iTunes, so we'd really appreciate that. And catch us next week, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to Thought Fuel. This show was created by Cameron Coward, and the music for the show was Shinamon Naneko by Roller Music.